All right. That is Iranian music, because we are talking about Iran today. We have a panel of wonderful and distinguished guests here in the studio. And why are we doing this? Well, I think partly we're doing it because, obviously, we're on the eve, potentially, of a historic agreement with Iran. Although, if you use, I don't know, YouTube, you might today or tomorrow get some alarming ad that comes up that is attacking Richard Blumenthal or worrying about how dangerous this pact is. And one of the things that we became aware of is that we really don't talk that much to people about the Iranian experience here in America, and that, you know, these cultures are maybe less estranged than people think they are. But one of the problems is, as I said before the news came on, is that Americans have these really long memories. So people of a certain age and people of a couple of generations, the thing they remember is the 1979 revolution. You know, the thing they remember is, you know, death to Carter, America is the great Satan. And what they don't understand is they don't understand a lot of things that we're going to point out today, including the fact that I think somewhere around 2/3 of the people alive in Iran right now were not alive at that time. And the country is just in a very different place. But Americans' heads don't easily get in this space with reality. So anyway, as we talk today, you're welcome to call in 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. And we'd really especially love it if you'd tweet at us at WNPR Colin. Our tweetmaster, Greg Hill, is in there. Now, I'm going to introduce all the people on the panel. I'm going to do my best not to – I practice really hard with the names, but I'll probably – make a minimum of 3 mistakes. But let's go. Afarin Ramanifar is an artist and professor of art and art history at Eastern Connecticut State College. Abbas Amanat is a professor of history at Yale and the director of Yale's program of Iranian studies. Nargis Arami is a professor of anthropology at Yale, and this may be the hardest one. Mercedes Pormagadam. I don't know why I can't learn that one. Pormagadam is a scientist and co-owner of the Lighthouse Bakery in Stonington. You may have read about her and her husband in Susan Campbell's very interesting column last Sunday. One of the many reasons we're doing this show today, although we actually already had it in the works when Susan's piece ran. So maybe the thing to do is to start with the historian in our midst, and Abbas. I was talking about how America kind of freeze-framed Iran at a certain moment. And I'm sure this is something that you run into in American attitudes. They know about that moment. They're much less clear about everything that's happened since 1979. How would you explain that if you ran into someone at Mercedes Bakery, you know, where Iran is now compared to where it was in 1979?
Well, certainly it was a traumatic experience for many of the Americans to see that a number of their diplomats have been detained for a long period of time. And all the rhetoric that came out of Iran during the time of the revolution and after, as you have yourself pointed out. And it is natural to see that a certain stereotype would emerge as a result, of which Iranians were always associated with certain extremism, certain anti-Americanism, and the general kind of a hostile attitude towards the West. The reality, as again you have pointed out, is that Iran is far away from that kind of an image some 30-odd years ago, 33, 34 years ago. Now we see a population that if would have a chance to express itself, probably is, although critical perhaps of many of the policies of the United States in the region, that is in the Middle East, but nevertheless, perhaps much more interesting to open up, much more interesting to engage with the West and with the United States in particular. And therefore, my explanation would be that you have a new kind of a society, the emergence of a new middle class. This is a society that has gone through a major shift over the past 30-odd years, if not longer. There is demographic revolution, in a sense, or explosion, whatever you would call it. There's a population in Iran in 1979 was something around 32-3 million. Today it is about 82-3 million, and it doubled itself. The the percentage of the youth in Iran is something below 25 is something probably about 60-65% or so. Perhaps others can correct me, Nayes, or others can correct me in that. There is a rate of literacy in Iran has grown up tremendously. It was something around the time of the revolution in the 1970s, around perhaps 60%, 50-60%. It depends what kind of statistics you look at. Today, probably it's around 90-95%. I mean,
And just to sort of maybe translate that into sort of images that people can recognize too. Nargis, as I was preparing for today's show, I started thinking, I wish I could go to Iran. I bet you there's some kind of grant I can get as a journalist and that I could go to Iran. But one of the things, some of my more modern images of Iran come from the movies of Farhadi, movies like A Separation and about Ellie, where I see kind of what Abbas is talking about. I see people who are both recognizable and maybe a little less recognizable, right? I see these angst-ridden members of Iran's middle class who are having the same problems basically that Americans are having in their personal lives. Maybe they're dressed a little bit differently. Maybe they're living with certain kinds of religious strictures that would be less familiar to me. But I feel like there's more in common than not.
Right. And I think that that is really highlighted best through film. And I think that's another aspect of Iranian society that has really grown. And some of it, not that it just has been renovated or remodeled, but has completely altered in various ways since 78, 79, and film, music, and arts are definitely part of that growth and emblematic of what the population is interested in and also what people in Iran are doing. And also that element that you're talking about, which has to do with these sort of universal characteristics that highlight stereotypes as well as collapse those stereotypes, make us feel as if we're connected to these characters on film, on screen, because of all those similarities and those elements that are very universal. But then there are those particular elements that are unique to Iranian culture and Iranian political scene that, for example, the hijab that women wear or the fact that you don't see those elements of people touching on screen, and except, if, of course, if they're children, only if children are involved. And those elements are things that can seem to stand out, especially for a general American audience.
Afarin, this is sort of something that you try to do, right? Use art to communicate about cultural differences and similarities.
Yes, exactly. You know, I remember vividly when I, that the days that I was sitting by Corsi or space heated kind of room, and having a conversation with the family member, mother, grandmother, and aunt, and then talking about, storytelling, talking about female storytelling. And that was the inspiration of my work, basically. And I wanted to portray and sort of construct images of female figures that it's the storytelling. I was quite fascinated with certain kind of characters, and I captured those characters, and I brought them into my work. And so characters such as Shahrzad, Jeannie, Barbie, and it was quite amazing. After we moved to United States in 1989, not long after that, my daughter, she was asking for a Barbie, which it was quite kind of ironic, because I came to understanding that it's just the suppressed society, suppressed expectation of society. It sort of applies to anywhere you go. So I had some sort of image in my mind, and I have a Western society in Iran, and but when I came here, I sort of noticed that that no matter where you go, you're always dealing with that kind of pressure.
At least that your choices aren't are not unconstrained by expectations, right? Mm-hmm. If you're in Iran, there's certain expectations for what a woman is, what a woman should look like, how a woman should dress. And you're here in America, and then there's a whole bunch of other socially conditioned expectations.
Yes, that this, you know, about the woman's body associated with identity of a woman, you know, and the expectation of the society of what the real expectation of female figure or body is and what society expects. From them. So that was the kind of, you know, starting point for me to create images. And I'm, you know, recently I received a grant. It's a CSU grant, and it's about retelling and unraveling stories of women that I wanted talk about. You know, it's from my perspective, from my personal view, and viewing all these women and unraveling and retelling the stories of those women.
Well, Merceda, the last time you were back in Iran, what did you see, and how different? How long had you been gone for in between trips, and how different did it look to you?
Well, my family immigrated to United States, which I consider my home, in 1978. Mm-hmm. And last time I was in Iran I left Iran in 1998 with my husband and my child. Mm-hmm. And I was there for a period of a year. So I had been away for many years. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of misconceptions that I see that very often mm-hmm. during my conversations with Americans, and one of them is that the role of women, actually, they're not very well aware that the majority of women in Iran are actually highly educated. Mm-hmm. They range from being doctors. Actually, my OB was a female who was educated in France, did her residency there, and then he returned back to Iran to practice. And I met with Iranian women who were professors, taught French, taught English, taught history, and they were CPAs, they were teachers, many walks of life. And some of them have started a small business, actually, on their own, and very successful. And, for example, I remember one of my husband's cousins who married with a high school degree after having two children with ages less than 5 years old, went back to school mm-hmm. and graduated with a college degree, and now she's employed. Mm-hmm. So, and their husbands actually are supporting them. So mm-hmm. this is the two of the misconceptions. I think that's extremely mm-hmm. important to for Americans to realize mm-hmm. that the Iranian women actually are much more free mm-hmm. and highly educated. So that's very important. And another misconception that I think that is extremely important is that Americans think majority of Iranians are very religious, or they are all Muslim. Mm-hmm. And Iranians range from being maybe not very religious, or sometimes they could be Jewish, Christian, or may not even practice Islam. This is another thing that could happen, that it could be in the United States or even in Iran itself.
Yeah, Farin, did you want to say something?
Yes, I want to point out also that women had a really active role in revolution. And after revolution, and because of that, the revolution, women gained greater kind of influence and power and in society. And I think for so many different reasons, political and you know, economical and kind of calls that they had. But I think essentially, their role is very different from the traditional role of women, and it's quite admiring in that sense. And go ahead.
No, please.
Well, I'm going to go over to you for a second.
More than half of the university graduates are female. It's mm-hmm. quite amazing number, and these number of female numbers that I'm giving you, there are many leading artists are females, and I have a story to tell everyone about Lily Golestan. She's the owner of a gallery in Tehran, and she started off with just opening her garage as a bookstore, and then she went to she turned it into a gallery, and then eventually she started going to Ministry of Culture every day and appearing there and saying, I want the permission to open a gallery. And the man in charge, he said, why you're here every day? Why? Where is your man? And she responded that, I don't have a man. And I mean, apparently she got the permission and she opened the most prominent gallery in Tehran. And she comes from a very strong background in art. And her father was a filmmaker, you know, and writer. So,
I want to go over to Abbas for a second here now, and sure. I want to hear from all of you about this. So, you know, on the other hand, my sense is that the relationship between some of the people, some of the enlightened and somewhat more liberated and empowered people that they're talking about right now, it is not necessarily consistent with the goals and attitudes of the regime that runs Iran.
Yes, precisely. It's interesting to note that what we may call the project of the Islamic Republic that was very ideologically driven and was very consistently imposed upon the general public in Iran after 35 years does not seem to have reached any of the objectives that it had. Or rather, it has been able to change the Iranian society to some extent. It's wrong to believe that they had no effect on the general public. But as it was pointed out by Mercedes and by Afarin, by everyone, the Iranian society has become much more complex, much more diverse than what it was before. I mean, the very fact that the Iranian visibility, women visibility in the Iranian society is so high, although perhaps not so much in the workplace, employment, in terms of employment, Iranian women are underrepresented, like many other places in the region. Nevertheless, you can consider that as some kind of a failure of the regime to put back women to the constraints of their home environment, and not allow them really to take part in the social life of the country. To some extent, this is because of the contradiction in the very objectives of the Islamic Republic. One should point this out. But yet at the same time is the fact that only perhaps 10 to 15% of the general public in Iran are really supporters of the regime. The remaining vast majority of the population may not necessarily wish to see an overthrow of this regime. But what they would like to see is an opening up of the political and social and cultural environment. I mean, if 2009, the Green Movement, is an evidence, we can clearly see that the Iranian public as a whole moves in the direction. Even the election of President Rouhani, in a sense, is a reflection of that kind of a shift in the Iranian public. That attitude that in the United States we often associate with militancy, with radicalism, with the Iranian general public, does not really has any reality. Does not have any really statistical backing. What you see is a society that sees itself being basically victimized in terms of employment, in terms of possibilities, and that's why you would see such a high immigration of the kind of a brain drain out of Iran into the West, the United States, Canada, Australia, Europe, mm-hmm. all of them, you see. The best of the Iranian educated are basically those who want to emigrate to the West.
So I want to just come back to the question of religion. Mercedes made a great point that there's more diversity than people think religiously, Nargis. And I read somewhere there's 7 kosher butcher shops in Tehran. On the other hand, Americans think of Iran, not unrealistically, as a theocracy, right? One that – I mean, you're sitting here in Connecticut, which is the last place in America to have an official state religion. We had an official state religion in Connecticut until 1818.
Nevertheless, the foundations of it was very religious.
Yes. Oh, yeah. The foundations of America were very religious, and Connecticut hung on to the notion – and it still is very religious. So what's the difference? In other words, if – the experience that we have here in the United States includes, for example, no atheist can ever run for president. We're not going to have an atheist president in my lifetime. So it's not as though religion and politics are really as separate as we claim they are. What's the difference in Iraq? What's in Iran? What's the subtle difference in Iran?
Well, on the surface of it, of course, as you pointed out, it's a theocracy. There is no doubt that that is what the political motivations were of the founders or the architects of the Constitution after 79 and even probably leading up to the revolution. But as I think in various ways it's been pointed out, the reality on the ground, just like the reality here, is that there is religious freedom, that there really truly isn't that kind of religious freedom in the United States in a sense that you can sure say what you want to say. But in reality, if you want to make good with your neighbors, if you live in a small town, you should probably be attending church. Or it's that those elements of, I guess, de facto de jure differences. If are we talking about by legal definition, then Iran is a theocracy. Do most people identify themselves as pious in some ways? Do they believe in spirituality or that there is some kind of God? Again, I think that's absolutely true. Even in popular music in Iran, you do see these elements of piety being pointed out or spirituality in different ways. Especially young people feel that there is resistance to the way they want to express themselves religiously? That's definitely the case. But they've also found creative ways of bringing their spirituality in sort of emotion with what sort of civil liberties would allow them to do, or the sort of the quashing of civil liberties would force them to do. So in some ways, it's a flip side of a coin where they're pushed to show that they are, demonstrate that they are religious. And at the same time, they are also demonstrating that they like to choose how that piety is their own individual expression, the way they pray, where they go to pray, what they wear. And those are basically the sorts of little gestures and material aesthetics that really show where their religiosity sits. They're also very, very reticent in anyone else telling them if they are or aren't pious.
That comes out. I mean, I apologize for being over-informed by Farhadi or books like Reading Lolita in Tehran and stuff like that. But this, until I get my grant to go there, that's what I'm stuck with basically. But you see that, right? Like in Farhadi's work, it's clear. One of the comparisons I make is to Mormonism. So Mormonism has a pretty strictly codified way of behaving, which not everybody follows. You know, you get to know Mormons pretty well. You find out you know some Mormons who drink coffee. You know Mormons who smoke. You know, Mormons who do all kinds of things that Mormons aren't supposed to do, because for the most part, people don't live quite so in such a doctrinaire way as they become more and more assimilated. In Farhadi, I see people who are not necessarily pious 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But then when they're arguing about something, when they get mad at one another, suddenly these very, very sort of pious invocations start, right? Well, now you're acting the wrong way. It's a little bit more fungible, a little bit more movable,
and
less
it's part
rigid.
Of the general human struggle of finding oneself. And that's, I think, his films definitely the sort of neorealism point that out. But I think that's true with everyone anywhere else. But those questions continue to inform one another. And what's really interesting is the level of alive and active discussion that happens amongst people in Iran from of course, cab drivers, which is always the way a lot of journalists are able to get their information. But everywhere that people are able to have these very sort of public spaces of discussion, and you see conversations about what their struggles are, from public for poetry to what's really become very much fashionable in Iran amongst all sorts of urban centers, as well as intergenerational, are taking self-help classes or advancement of or betterment of self through musical instruments to voice classes to art classes to all sorts of self-help groups that really indicate that it is a personal and a public struggle, and the public now is taking ownership of that particular personal struggle.
All right. We're going to grab a quick break here. Things are moving along. We'd love to hear from you as well. Feel free to tweet us at WNPRColin as we go, talking about the experiences of Iranian Americans. All right, we're back. We're talking about the experience of Iranian Americans and conditions in Iran right now, but also what it's like to come here. So we have a great panel here. If I introduce them all, the show will be over. So I'll gradually, as we go along here, kind of remind you of who they are. I want to talk a little bit also about why people leave, why people come here. Everybody who's sitting here in my studio has a story, but so does one of our callers here. Actually, Jason is the reason that we're doing this show. He emailed me a while ago and suggested a show like this one. Jason Nushin is an Anglo-Iranian artist. So, Jason, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, everybody.
So tell us a little of your story. Tell us sort of what your experience was in Iran and how it was that you came to America.
Well, I was born in England, and I went to Iran when I was 3 months old, and I was raised by my grandmother and aunt. My aunt was Masumeh Sehun. She was a gallery owner and an artist. And her husband was Hushang Sehun, who was an eminent Iranian architect. So I lived there during the Shah's regime, and I was there when the revolution happened in 79 and the ensuing war with Iraq. So I think that actually what Iran is today is a product of that war. And if that war hadn't have happened, Iran wouldn't have been as tightly controlled as it is by the regime.
How is it that you came back to the West?
Well, I left for a year. We went to Paris, and I was with my grandmother, and she couldn't live there because she wanted to go back to Iran. So we went back to Iran, and the conditions were really hard. And I was 13, and my 14th birthday would have been the year that I would have been called for duty to fight the Iran-Iraq war. And my aunt was very concerned, so she got my brother and myself out. And so we left, and we went to England, and that's where we lived.
Mercedes, 14 was, I think, the age you were when you first left. Is that right?
Yes. My family immigrated to United States in 78, I was 14. I started high school in Northern California, my brother and I. And the main reason my family immigrated to the United States was for attaining higher education. Because at that time, this was prior to any kind of uprising, to get any kind of a degree from the Western country, you would have had a better future coming back to the United States.
Although the uprising came soon after
yes.
that. So it's hard enough to be a teenager anywhere.
Yes.
It must have been very difficult to be a teenager of Iranian background in America around 1979 and 1980.
That is true. However, I think we lived in a very small town in Northern California. It's called San Rafael, which I'm very happy I attended Santa Fe High School there. You would think that we would have a difficult time, but I have to say that's over 30 years ago. And my brother and I, we never felt any animosity, any insults, or any kind of, a difficult time. And mainly it was because of the teachers and the principal. They all... it was a town and a school that was 99.9% Caucasian, actually. However, we felt at home because we were able to express ourselves, and they made a forum, actually, so that this, and other teenagers, other students would be able to ask any type of questions, and if they had any curiosity. And they found out that we were just like them. We were just teenagers and attending a high school. And it made it much more easier to assimilate. And also they accepted us as a classmate. And so and it's sad to say that here in Connecticut, after over 30 years, we have not felt welcomed. In 2001, because of a job situation for Pfizer, I am a scientist, we moved to Connecticut. And my son, who is actually accompanying me today, he's a 16-year-old, he attended, started kindergarten in our small town here in Mystic, southeastern Connecticut. And as a third grader, when he reached, he was only 8 years old, he was called a terrorist by other children. Mm. And those children's parents are educated. I used to believe that education would open minds, but unfortunately I have come to this conclusion that that could be wrong. It shows that, and that school is also 99.9% Caucasian. Mm-hmm. However, I don't know whether it's geographical or it's just there could be other reasons. But I think, unfortunately, some of these feelings starts from home. Mm-hmm. And we have felt it in our business also, and that's Stonington. And there was an article that was published on Sunday by Susan Campbell in the Hartford Current. And I would invite everyone that is listening to take a look at that article. And I also would invite Attorney Nadidi Moses from Civil Rights Division of the DOJ to investigate the town and the police department for this matter, which is important, I believe, is extremely important.
Susan's column was very upsetting. Although I will say that I put Susan's column up on Facebook and said, this is really upsetting. And
However, may I add something? I want to thank everybody. There are good and bad people in every nation or race. And I want to thank everyone because we had such a extremely positive outpouring from everybody.
That's what I was going to say. I put it up on Facebook.
I want to thank
hundreds
everybody.
Of people,
yes.
Yeah, hundreds of people were saying everything from, yes, let's do a mass visit to the bakery, and then people were getting, well, that's not a good idea because they'll run out of stuff, so let's give them a warning.
But I want to appreciate that there are many, many people who have supported us, and I appreciate that, and it's very heartwarming.
So, Afarin, I want to hear your story of leaving Iran, but before we do that, just because she mentioned 9/11, Nargis, I think this is sort of an important point that, you know, Americans sometimes are – well, I was on commercial, you know, drive time talk radio when 9/11 happened. So I was hearing from some of the most unenlightened people on the face of the earth. And they were absolutely incapable of distinguishing one Middle Easterner from another, one background from another, an Arab from a Persian. I mean, it just was all just one thing to them. And people were in a complete panic, and all of their xenophobia was coming out. And as a result, I mean, I think in ways that Mercedes' story of what her son heard. I mean, that's not uncommon, right? Americans had they just were unwilling to make any kind of discernments at that moment.
Specifically after 9/11, I think that a lot of people did witness comments being made, especially to young men. And I mean, I'd heard that across the region, things that people hadn't heard since Iranian students were in the United States in 78, 79, and the hostage crisis really highlighted, especially those in California. And I recall my uncle, who was at USC at the time, talking about the very very sort of physical and personal attacks that would happen. And it didn't seem like there was much of that in California until 9/11. And I think that people had a really difficult time telling the difference between a Sikh and an Iranian or an Arab, or what their religious identity was, or if that even mattered. And so there was definitely a communal stereotyping that was happening, that sometimes it also added to anxieties amongst Iranians wanting to separate themselves from being considered South Asian, Arab, or what have you, which is also a problem onto its own because it does create this notion that, oh, we are very different than everyone else. And that creates problems within communities as well, especially because, you know, as we're seeing collapse into one giant Middle East or one Muslim world, and there's variations there as well.
Mm-hmm. All of these are topics for entire shows, but Avareen, tell us. You've already sort of, I think, hinted at some of the reasons that you left Iran, but tell us the story of your departure.
Well, mainly we left Iran for higher education purposes and reasons. I want to get my higher degree here. And it was quite amazing because, you know, as an artist, I always felt compelled that I need to make my statement through the imagery that I create. So I express myself through the imagery and the language that I have. It's a combination. It's the mixture, and I wanted to juxtapose kind of imagery that I grew up with. And the degree that I had, it's a Persian miniature painting in Iran, and then getting the Western kind of skills here and learning about that and kind of bringing these two areas together. That was my intention. And I wanted to, you know, create the images of feminine figures, you know, or space that I create in my paintings. And you know, after a while, you know, it wasn't easy. It was always a struggle for an artist, you know, everyday struggle to figure out, okay, I have all these ideas. Now I want to know how to make it happen and how to make that imagery kind of make a dialogue with the audience. That was my challenge and struggle that I went through. So finally, gradually, you know, I started creating images and capturing and reading and kind of researching different characters of pop culture or female figures in Persian painting or Qajar women figures. So anyway, I started to establish myself and my thoughts as a woman living and experiencing a different culture and came to the point that always this question was raised in my mind that where do I belong? You know, it's the kind of shifting status that you constantly as a person migrated from another country, you always feel that kind of shift that this is the time that I am Iranian, now I'm American. You know, it's kind of brought me to the question that where do I belong? You know, this belonging question is that I go through this process of questioning that it was I figured it out and I'm like, okay, this is my emotional character. I have two characters, emotional character, and I have the more kind of intellectual character. And my emotional character, it takes me back. It sort of holds me to my past. And I feel like that I'm Iranian. I feel really attached to that and I cannot separate myself from that, obviously. But and then my and then the desire to tell the poetry, to portray the poetry and portray my personal stories, that was another story. Then learning about the skills or Western.
All right, I'm going to have to just interrupt you. I'm getting a little signal. We've got to go to a break here. So hold that thought, Avareen. We're going to grab a quick break here. When we come back, too, we want to talk a little bit to everybody involved here about sort of how they talk about the impending deal between the United States and Iran.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Our intern is Katie McAuliffe, and Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by Christian Amanpour. For show pages, articles, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff making cello kebabs, visit our website, WNPR.org/Colin. Tomorrow we reshare a show about modern words. And now, back to Colin.
All right, so we're back. Our time is fleeting here, and I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about a subject that that seems to occupy the thoughts of Americans right now. So, Abbas Amanat, I'm going to start with you, professor of history at Yale and director of Yale's program of Iranian studies. I was on my computer today. I was on YouTube, and these ads would flash up, and there'd be red things and flames, and it would say, "Tell Richard Blumenthal not to approve this deal. This is dangerous. Iran is dangerous." As you try to kind of translate all of this for an American audience, what do you tell people?
Well, I'm actually astonished by the degree of resistance and negative attitude that we witness today against this rather remarkable deal. From the perspective of a historian, one thing I can say, I mean, the past course of the past at least century, Iran has never witnessed or signed an agreement so restricting, so constraining in terms of what it can or cannot do, in terms of being intrusive in the life of the country, and particularly in a revolutionary regime in Iran. So I'm, in certain respect, I think one can say President Obama should be congratulated for being able to orchestrate such a global support in terms of sanctions and in terms of bringing Iran to sign this document. Particularly, I'm astonished because of the fact that I see that this kind of opposition to the agreement within the United States is so much tied up to pressure groups, both within the country and outside. And this I would find actually rather distressing. This is one experience as an Iranian-American in this country, that I can see that so much of these pressure groups can actually bend and shape the public opinion in this country. And I very much hope that eventually this would be a successful deal, not only for the sake of Iran or for the sake of the United States, but for the sake of the region as a whole. Iran, one should bear in mind, that possibly is the only stable country in the region, with the exception of Turkey, whether Turkey would consider itself as part of the Middle East or not. But anywhere from Pakistan to Egypt, if you look at, Iran is a country that no matter how much the regime is can be blamed or criticized for its human rights policies, for its all kinds of failings in terms of human in terms of environment, in terms of foreign policy, in terms of all other domestic policies of the Islamic Republic, one thing can be said, that it is a country that it's stable in the midst of a region that all around it, as you look, Afghanistan, Iraq, even one might go Pakistan, even might point out in eastern Turkey, there is a volatility, a degree of volatility. And the fact that the Iranian population as a whole are supportive of opening up and creating a dialogue with the outside world. And I think that's something that should be encouraged on the side of the United States, rather than this kind of a negative attitude that would isolate Iran, would play into the hands of the hardliners in Iran, and eventually the outcome of it is going to be further instability and volatility in the region with global consequences. Just look at what's happening around us when a country like Germany this year is about to accept immigrants, most of them refugees, from the Middle East at the rate of 1 million people, 1% of the population.
I want to just move on. I want to hear a few more voices here before we run out of time. So Narges Arami, who's a professor of anthropology at Yale, you know, I was reading one article that actually was written by an old friend of mine, writes for the New York Times in 2013. She was in Iran on a sort of 10-day tour there and just was able to talk to people, young people in the streets. And she kind of found this sort of approach avoidance, right? This, we love America, we love American culture. And there's also kind of, well, America, you've had your foot on our neck for a long time too. What assumes that one of the things that would happen if this pact, if this agreement is approved, is that some of that ambivalence would go away?
I think mostly I can point out, having had a few cousins this summer visiting from Iran to the United States, one thing that they were all excited about is that if this does go through and it's approved, that they are hopeful that a lot of the people who are in power in Iran, who've been having the kind of hold, an economic hold, and on exports and imports in various ways, will be forced to open up. That this would allow everyone to have access to so many different things, and there wouldn't be this huge black market in Iran in terms of getting to things or in terms of accessing different possibilities from sort of getting onto the internet to all kinds of things that they are hopeful that it would open up. And at the same time, they do see that this is and as it's been pointed out by everyone here, that there is this desire, which one can argue existed before 78 for civil liberties and maybe stopped for a short period of time as other things were developing in terms of the revolution and continued, and as the caller had talked about in terms of the war. And so questions about civil liberties again took this sort of step back, which were again, I think, the things that were on the surface in probably from the early 70s onwards and a sort of global phenomenon that this the question of sanctions and the way that the Iranian state has been treated as well as the Iranian population had a lot to do with the fact that very few people who are in power and who, for the most part, most young people feel like probably are in cahoots with sanctions happening for them to have absolute control over how things come in and out of Iran would open up and that there would be less control of that.
Jason Mnuchin, really quickly, because we're running out of time. I know you feel as though the approval of this pact would have profound, far-reaching implications for Iranians.
Absolutely. You know, this deal is a 10-year deal. So we're looking at, 2025, 2026? And by then, all the people who are in charge right now are either going to be dead or retired. So they're going to be replaced by this new generation of Iranians who didn't see the revolution. They don't have all that luggage with them. And you know, what better time to open up relations? And plus, Iran has an incredible cuisine. Iranian food is the best in the world.
I agree.
You need to go to Tehran, Colin, and taste the food.
All right. No, I want to get that grade so I can go there. But meanwhile, I could go to the Lighthouse Bakery in Stonington. Mercedes Permagadam, tell us, do you in fact serve Iranian baked goods there? I mean, can I try Iranian treats there when I go there?
Well, the Iranian bakeries have such a great influence from Europeans all the time. So all the European baked goods that you see in Europe are actually can be served in bakeries in Iran. And we have them, but we also have baklava. And but what I wanted to mention is that besides the financial stability that this approval is going to bring to Iran, to every individual, there's some business people that actually do business with China, and they are constrained to do business with Europe, and that would open up the doors not only for Iranians but also for American companies, which would be able to do business. And that once that is done, I think the people will be able to communicate better and understand one another, because I think both people would be able to learn from one another.
All right. They're telling me we have to stop. I want to thank everybody who was here today, Afarin, Abbas, Nargis, Mercedes, and Jason Mnuchin on the phone. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan also for producing this show, and to Kion Wolf for being on the board. Thanks to everybody who helped out today. Katie McAuliffe, I think, on phones as well. We will be back tomorrow. Actually, I won't be back tomorrow, but one of our favorite shows from this year will be back tomorrow. Thanks for joining us today.